All right, so this is a chant on page 59, Metta or Loving Kindness Sutra, which is a lot of Brahma Vihara, and that's part of our class. Metta Sutra. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble, not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding by not holding to fixed views. The pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you. So, in case you are new to this class series, Opening Your Heart, this is the fifth class, and it will go through February, and then in March, we will begin our annual precept study. Precepts are the moral guidelines of our tradition. So we have already had a class on the first three of the Brahma Viharas, or the Divine Abidings. So these are old Buddhist teaching. The first Brahma Vihara is metta, or loving kindness or friendliness. I like the translation goodwill. feels a little more doable sometimes when things are challenging. Compassion or karuna is the second Brahmavihara. Sympathetic joy or mudita is what we talked about last week. And there's recordings of all of these classes on the website. We record audio and video. And then tonight, we're talking about equanimity or upeka. So just briefly to review, these different qualities are the qualities of an enlightened being. When we are awakened, this is how we naturally are. So we can work toward these things in many ways. In some ways, all of our practice is moving us toward being more of an awakened person. So it should be moving us toward having feeling greater goodwill toward all beings, more compassion, more sympathetic joy, more equanimity. In particular, our understanding of what I like to call reality with a capital R, which gives us the largest possible perspective, is something which can particularly help with upeka or equanimity. So I'll talk more about that later. The way that these teachings, the Brahmaviharas in particular, arose in Buddhism, in the Buddha's teachings, they're really like almost like meditative exercises that you do to really try to directly work on them, right? Rather than kind of like, let's work on our understanding so that eventually we'll feel more open-heartedness and compassion, we could also just work like on our open-heartedness and compassion. So the general pattern is to start by thinking of someone for whom you feel the Brahmavihara very easily. So metta practice is the most common practice. So you think of a being, sometimes it has to be an animal or something, toward whom you feel just instant, easy, unconditional goodwill. A child, you know, so you call that being to mind, and then you really allow yourself to feel that goodwill. And then you call to mind somebody who's just a little bit more challenging to feel that for, and you really practice extending that feeling toward more and more beings. So we think of it as expanding our circle of beings for whom we can feel goodwill. And goodwill, if we feel goodwill for a being and we see them suffer, then we naturally feel compassion or karuna. We feel goodwill for a being and we see them happy and experiencing good fortune, we naturally feel sympathetic joy. So we can also try to expand compassion and sympathetic joy in a very mindful way. So the four are kind of listed in order of difficulty. So metta, although I don't know, metta and or goodwill and compassion, I feel like could kind of maybe switch places. Goodwill is simplest, but a lot of times I think we actually can access goodwill for someone more easily when we see them suffer, right? If we see someone, maybe we have a little difficulty with, but then when we see that they're suffering, it's like there's kind of a softening toward them and a natural concern. So, you know, metta and are the goodwill and compassion, you know, go pretty close hand in hand. Sympathetic joy is a little more difficult. I mean, it seems natural that, you know, compassion, you should feel compassion for beings because they're suffering and we should help, right? But if they're doing great, you know, why do you need to, you know, why make this effort to kind of feel joy on their behalf? But we talked about that last week of just, and this is really about opening our own hearts. So then upeka is considered the trickiest. So that's what we'll talk about tonight. So the near enemy of upeka is indifference. So a lot of times I think when we hear equanimity, I mean, we hear, okay, goodwill, that's lovely. Compassion, that's lovely. Sympathetic joy, that's lovely. And then equanimity is kind of like, what does that mean? So then you're just kind of unmoved. You don't really care. It doesn't seem to have a very emotional quality to it or very warm quality to it. So I figured I would let Thich Nhat Hanh explain to us why. So he says in this reading, which I would love for a cloud volunteer, I'm going to put a link in the chat and I can volunteer to read it. That would be super. Upeksha, he calls it. Now, upeka or upeksha, those are just, it's the Pali version versus the Sanskrit version. So there's often two versions of these older terms. Volunteer from the cloud. You waiting to see the link? There's the link. I just like for you all not have to listen to my voice the entire time. Great, Leah. Thank you. It's just about a page.
Jinryu, you can read it if you want. We both put our hands up at the same time.
After you.
Thank you. So go ahead, Leah. You're muted again.
Sorry about that. Okay, here we go. The fourth element of true love is upeksha, which means equanimity, non-attachment, non-discrimination, even-mindedness, or letting go. Upe means over, and kish means to look. You climb the mountain to be able to look over the whole situation, not bound by one side or the other. If your love has attachment, discrimination, prejudice, or clinging in it, it is not true love. People who do not understand Buddhism sometimes think upeksha means indifference, but true equanimity is neither cold nor indifferent. If you have more than one child, they are all your children. Upeksha does not mean that you don't love. You love in a way that all your children receive your love without discrimination. Upeksha has the mark called the wisdom of equality, the ability to see everyone as equal, not discriminating between ourselves and others. In a conflict, even though we are deeply concerned, we remain impartial, able to love and to understand both sides. We shed all discrimination and prejudice and remove all boundaries between ourselves and others. As long as we see ourselves as the one who loves and the other as the one who is loved, as long as we value ourselves more than others or see others as different from us, we do not have true equanimity. We have to put ourselves into the other person's skin and become one with him if we want to understand and truly love him. When that happens, there is no self and no other. Without upeksha, your love may become possessive. A summer breeze may be very refreshing, but if we try to put it in a tin can so we can have it entirely for ourselves, the breeze will die. Our beloved is the same. He is like a cloud, a breeze, a flower. If you imprison him in a tin can, he will die. Yet many people do just that. They rob their loved one of this liberty until he can no longer be himself. They live to satisfy themselves and use their loved one to help them fulfill that. That is not loving, it is destroying. You say you love him, but if you do not understand his aspirations, his needs, his differences, he is in a prison called love. True love allows you to preserve your freedom and the freedom of your beloved. That is upeksha. For love to be true love, it must contain compassion, joy, and equanimity in it. For compassion to be true compassion, it has to have love, joy, and equanimity in it. True joy has to contain love, compassion, and equanimity. And true equanimity has to have love, compassion, and joy in it. This is the interbeing nature of the four immeasurable minds. We must look deeply and practice them for ourselves to bring these four aspects of love into our own lives and into the lives we love.
You. Now I was thinking about how when we start talking about equanimity, it'd be very easy for many of us to think of all the ways in which we don't feel equanimity. But in fact, there are lots and lots and lots of situations and people about which you feel plenty of equanimity. I mean, you probably feel equanimity about more people in situations than you don't. We just don't really think about that. Because this equanimity is not, it's not a lack of compassion. So if you think about doctors, nurses, first responders, if they weren't able to access a degree of equanimity, they couldn't do their work. I mean, you know, it's completely like, if it's you that just gets the cancer diagnosis, if it's your loved one who gets it, versus if you are a doctor who is, you know, kind of tells people about that all the time, like you have a very different relationship to the situation. So when a doctor can tell somebody about something like that with equanimity, you know, it's not at all a coldness. It's just a different relationship to the situation. So it does bring up, I mean, really, what is the nature of this equanimity? What are we talking about here? So I figured we'd do another brainstorm. I will pull up a brainstorm sheet and we can share. Really trying to get at this, when we're experiencing equanimity or some other words that I liked, was that wisdom of equality, that even-mindedness. When we're experiencing that, you know, what are some other words that come to mind? What other are some of the like physical and mental experiences of this, or like qualities of it? And yeah, those, I can't see everybody on in the cloud because I've shared my screen. So if you want to say something, please like use the raise hand feature, which is down under reactions. And in the dirt sendo, you could call something out if you like.
Balance.
Balance. Aaliyah.
Feeling grounded.
John.
Intimacy or authenticity.
Receptiveness. Boundaries.
Boundaries. And I kind of think of boundaries like, I don't know, I like a, like it being kind of easy and natural to set boundaries. It wouldn't be a big like, a reactive,
just have
worried thing. It would just be kind of
clarity.
Boundaryless. Do you have another one, John?
Yeah, I'd like to add feeling open.
Oh, you muted yourself there.
Yeah, I'd like to add feeling open.
Feeling open. Charles.
I was just going to say not wanting things to be other than how they actually are.
Not wanting things other than how they are.
Positive intent.
Assuming positive intent.
Non-reactive.
Non-reactive. Jinryu.
Unambiguous.
Out judgment. I think about when I took Aikido and how really what we were cultivating was the ability to maintain whatever this thing is, right? This equanimity. No matter what came at you, which is like, it's all fine. Like, we're all sitting zazen. We can just like, you know, can feel perhaps plenty of equanimity. But when stuff is coming at you, the reactivity just, you know, is very habitual and easily arises. And the way that they described it in my Aikido classes were like, you allow your mind to be led. It's like your mind gets led away from this, you know, people have said like this kind of authenticity and groundedness. And so when something comes at us, we're like pulled off center. So in some ways I was thinking it's actually maybe even easier to think about like, well, what's not equanimity, right? Like, not equanimity over here in this column. Say like agitation. Fearfulness,
projection,
rejection,
extremes,
self-preservation. One of the things that we talked about in Aikido was anticipation, right? Like you're trying to kind of, rather than just dealing with things as they arise, you're anticipating.
Separation.
Judgment.
Jinryu.
Unclear.
So when you look at things this way, it's like you can see where we're not talking about not feeling anything. Like Thich Nhat Hanh's talking about it, you know, it has love and joy and compassion in it. But all of this is like, this is, you can see where this is a good thing to feel like sometimes you think about these are the social emotions. These are the emotions when we're interacting with other beings and with the rest of the world. These are ideal, you know, this is how the enlightened being feels. And that it's a beneficial thing to beings. So, also, another translation of it was, or description of it was inclusiveness. Inclusiveness. Not really, that really fits with my whole Aikido experience as well. Like that, if you oppose, then there's conflict. But when you're like, all right, this is what's happening. Then you can take that energy, you know, Aikido is famous for like, and then I take your energy and then you fall down with it, you know? So taking the self out of the picture. So I have a little meditation for us, and then we can reflect after that. About how we cultivate equanimity. So if you like, you can close your eyes if you like. You don't have to, but. So imagine you live out a long, happy life. You live as long as you want to. You end up dying in the, you know, as good a circumstances as possible. And then when you pass away, you find you're able to see what happens in the world after you are gone. You're able to move around and witness the lives of your loved ones, your community, your nation. You can watch what happens to groups, institutions you cared about, things you were involved in. You're able to watch them go on without you. They have good memories of you. And you keep witnessing life as the years pass. Now imagine 5 years have passed since your passing. Your loved ones are happy and doing well. Children grow. People get married. Careers begin and end. Things start to change. Now imagine 10 years have passed. Call to mind the people, the places and things you care about. 10 years after you have gone. How might things have changed? Your family, your children, nieces, nephews. Your home. Your sangha. Your work. Things you worked hard on and left behind. Now imagine 20 years have passed. People still around. It would remember you, that many things probably changed, such that you hardly would recognize them anymore. Now imagine 50 years have passed. Now, even those you left behind, things you left behind, may also have passed. Life goes on. Children are born. People live their lives. Now imagine you are looking on 100 years after you have died. You can go anywhere. See what's going on. But it's been 100 years since you were there and part of it. Now imagine it's been 500 years. Look around at that 500 years on world and send metta to the beings of that time. As you come back to this time, think about how different you felt. As your being and life was more and more remote from personal involvement. What is going on? And when to share an observation or reflection. Yeah.
I have tried this meditation before, and second time felt the same. I feel like if I practiced it more often, it would get easier and less uncomfortable. I find it to be an uncomfortable exercise. And that to me is reflecting back, hey, you know, if I were in equanimity mode, it would be a better feeling the further and further I got. But as it feels like it feels worse and worse. So I guess repeat.
Or maybe it's not the right exercise for it, for cultivating equanimity. I don't know.
There.
John.
So I had to kind of change it up a little bit. As you went further and further in the future, I had to imagine myself starting earlier and earlier, like, so 1925 for 100 years ago, or 1525 for 500 years ago, because climate change and all that kind of shit, I couldn't get that out of my, you know, like there wasn't going to be a future. So I had to do something that worked for me, but, you know, it takes self out of the equation as you get further and further, right? I mean, if you care for the people of the times and metta and goodwill and all that kind of stuff, it really takes self out of the situation. So I found it a good exercise for that. You can kind of think more equanimous, you know, when you don't have specific people you care about, you just care about everybody and hope things are well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Coral and then Denny.
Like Leah, this is the second time I've done this exercise. And on Tuesday nights, I always come in flustered from work, a long day at work. And I'm really frustrated at work right now. And none of that shit seems to matter 500 years from now. And it's kind of like this, I don't know, it's a release. I'm like, oh, wow. You know, all I can do is my best right now. And that's good. Yeah.
I think it, I mean, the how this exercise affects people may depend on, I don't know, maybe like what your attachments are or something, but definitely for me, this was like, I deliberately put in there like all the stuff you worked really hard to achieve and leave behind, right? And it's like, I mean, honestly, even like 10 years and it's starting, I mean, I think of this, like my yard that I put all this effort into to make native and like work so hard on and like, and seriously, like probably 10 years from now, somebody else will own it and they'll like take everything out and put grass in, you know,
I get into a park.
I mean, so.
Yeah. Wonderful. I mean, I guess you could look at that with frustration. But I don't. People do what they want.
But you just realize like how once you look at that larger perspective, it's just like, oh man, you know, all of this is so sometimes so small.
Yeah.
Denny.
Yeah, this really hit home with me. Because, I think it's because I've lived long enough that I've actually been experiencing the feeling of seeing loved ones pass away and the home that I loved visiting was my grandparents' home, and it's no longer there. And there are close friends of mine who have passed away. Everything. I mean, it. The longer I live, and I'm going to turn 72 this week. The more distance I seem to experience from important parts of my life. Mm-hmm. And so I've been really finding myself not literally, but meditating on impermanence and really getting to know the feeling of impermanence. And when you start to get comfortable with that, you do feel equanimity at the same time, or more than I used to feel, because I was much more attached to experiences and holding on to people and that sort of thing. And I'm already, you know, looking at my native gardens in the backyard that I love and thinking to myself, yeah, you know, I wonder what all of this is going to be like 20, 30 years from now when I'm likely not going to be here. So I think it's a process that we may all go through if we're as meditators and Zen Buddhists really coming to terms with impermanence and change. And oh, and then when I was 500 years away, I felt like I was completely gone. I was no self at all. My self had just, you know, been absorbed in everything else. So anyway, it was an interesting experience for me.
You know, I think it's true that, you know, some of this comes, I mean, it doesn't, when you get older, you don't necessarily get wiser, because it's not a done, you know, guarantee, but definitely the, you know, the perspective that comes with age, as people have heard me, you know, use the kind of comparison of like, you know, you have, you're with a little child and they break their favorite toy and they're just absolutely inconsolable. And you're going to be compassionate, right? You're going to like, it's so you feel compassion for their pain and you're not judging them for their pain, right? From their perspective, this is a very terrible and painful thing. But from your perspective, it's like, you know, whatever. You'll have favorite toy next week, a different toy that you have, you know, there's many toys in the world. You're going to have a lot of experiences, right? So like from your perspective, it's not upsetting. And then similarly, you know, through our lives, as we experience more, you know, we don't get as upset as teenagers do about certain things, right? Like that there's the first love, very hurts a lot to lose, but actually the next one will probably be better. And, you know, and then as you get older, when you've seen people come and go, and you've seen, I mean, I don't know, hopefully it won't make anybody sad, but I mean, this is a sad story, but my husband, when he was and his first wife, she had a miscarriage and she was very upset and she talked to his mother and his mother got right on the phone and just said, "Oh, I heard you had a little miss." You know, it's like these women have experienced this a lot. You know, she probably had experienced many of them, all the women she knew. So in that larger perspective, it was like, now join those of us who had that experience. So the larger perspective, we don't only have to wait for our life experience to give us that. We can also be working on our practice. Be working on our sense of, you know, people and talking about impermanence, of emptiness, of suchness, of how things are that precious just the way they are. If we're viewing them without the filter of our expectations and our preconceived notions, they just are the way they are. And in that context, that trying to maintain our centeredness, not letting our minds be led, seems like a just really essential, wonderful practice that can benefit not just us, but all beings. And I think it's very, very appropriate. We didn't talk about specifics, but very appropriate that we're having a class on equanimity right now. And what sprang to my mind, I'm probably not the only one thinking about this right now, but there were, as many of you know, there were three posters put out by the British government in World War II. To encourage people, keep calm and carry on. And these were, they ended up, they, these posters weren't actually like, it's not like people kept calm and carried on because they put these posters out there, right? Because they didn't actually put them any of them out. This is really more of the description of people, what people were doing. Another one was your, and they had the your underlined, your courage, your cheerfulness, your resolution will bring us victory. Your courage, your cheerfulness, your resolution would bring us victory. And these are like, these are folks whose bombs were falling on, you know? And then freedom is in peril. Defend it with all your might. That one doesn't have so much to do with equanimity, but I thought I'd throw it in there because it seems appropriate. Even-mindedness, trying to extend it. It's not easy, but I think just identifying that this is a valuable thing to cultivate, you know, gives us a place to put our practice. Ruth Ann, do you have something?
Yes, thank you for this. I'm grateful for this because I thought of my friends in their 20s and 30s. I tell them I'm proud of them, which I am, and I think, oh, they have, just like listening to Coral right now. I thought, yay for the future. And then 100 years from now, 500 years, I just wish, I lament, I don't have any billionaire friends to shake and say, look what you could do for the earth that you're not doing. You know, I felt this urgency that we can't leave a mess. And then I thought, oh, this is not the right meditation for me.
maybe not. Yeah, it does introduce a different dimension. Although, I mean, I'm not really, I don't know. Thich Nhat Hanh.
But I,
yeah, go ahead, Ruth Ann.
I'm triggered by asking you about let yourself be led. That is that falls in, of course, with our Buddhist point of view of ease and not needing to control or put our spin on something. But if you could just elaborate a bit.
Well, you know, in a way that is a metaphor that can be interpreted a couple different ways, right? So letting yourself be led could mean the way I think you're meaning it, like kind of let your response arise naturally from, you know, what you are encountering, that kind of thing, kind of be led by, you know, your spirit, or in the Aikido context, it was letting yourself be led by, in a negative way, by someone else, by someone else's aggression. And so then your mind goes the way they are asking it to go. So in a way, you could look and say, you know, a lot of the stuff out in our media right now is trying to lead our minds, down paths of being divisive and angry and freaked out and all that. So yeah. But yeah, in terms of the far, far future, it is valuable to have equanimity even about that. I mean, I'm not saying that I have that. I have great grief and determination, but I was really moved by something I heard Thich Nhat Hanh say, which was that we have to make our peace with the possibility that our civilization will end. And not make our peace, not meaning, I mean, because that can be easily misunderstood, not make our peace as in resign ourselves to it and just accept it or whatever. But there's a way that whenever we're holding something as like, this can't happen, this must not, this cannot be, then we are, we're still entangled with it. We're not feeling that kind of equanimity, which allows us to remain centered and strong, and then respond more effectively. So I don't know. I think about stardust and tardigrades. I mean, seriously, I think about life. I mean, life in some form will go on. Being will go on. And I find a great solace in that. that excuses nothing, right? I mean, that's like, just because, you know, everything's precious just as it is, we still have a precept against not killing. We still say every, you know, life increases, every life increases the life of Buddha. How do we say that exactly? You know, so at the same time, both are true.
Oh, yeah, great. Mm-hmm. Cool. Thank you. I appreciate that. The image of, you know, the connection is there with whatever our elements are on the planet. We're already there. So
yeah.
Thank you. That helps.
And then one more, Natalie.
I was just going to say, I did feel more equanimity as I moved further into the future. I felt a lot of attachment when I felt, okay, if this were going to happen right now, you know, my kid and other loved ones, I could feel myself wanting to, you know, just hold on tightly and very passionate, you know, that not equanimous, but extreme emotions of, oh, I hope they're going to be okay. And, you know, as I feel them join me. Yeah, like you were talking about, if someone's your patient versus your close family member, like there's care, but I wasn't as, you know, personally involved and personally invested. Mm-hmm. And going 500 years out, for me, I actually felt quite a bit of peace, even realizing, I know we're talking about, will this planet be able to sustain human life? One of my feelings, though, is that this universe is so vast that, you know, the energy comes back. And even if it's not the way we see it here on this earth in this way, it's somewhere. I think there's different dimensions, different life sustaining planets. I think there's so much more that. Yeah, I felt that peace just knowing somehow it all goes on and it ultimately be okay. So for me, this exercise did help me bring me in that direction.
Mm-hmm. So, good. Yeah. Thank you. All right. We dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you all for coming.
Happy birthday, Jenny.
Yeah.